Welcome in this new week with starting with virtual machines. So we try to agree upon the basic architectural features of our virtual machine. So as usual, we have a dedicated data space for the text space, a text segment, if you like, for the program code. That is the same as for the C machine. And also we need some a stack. So in this case, it's just a stack. We also need a data area or a data structure where we can maintain dynamically allocated memory objects. And once again, this is because this is important. For the functional languages, it is not necessary that the data, the dynamic data are in the same address space as the stack data, as it is important for C, because in C you have a uniform address space. This is not the case here. We cannot directly access addresses, and so this gives us more freedom in the organization of our virtual machine. So this is the same, by the way, for Java, where you also have no direct access to the addresses, and therefore there you also have the freedom to have a dedicated object store, if you like, where you can maintain your dynamic data and where you can have garbage collection and things like that. So in C, garbage collection is much more difficult, because an address is an address is an address and nothing else. And even if you have no pointer to something, it might be that you may reach this particular data area by doing some kind of address calculation. Yeah. So in this sense, C is more low level and in some sense more difficult and less convenient as functional or object-oriented languages in the Java style. So here is once again the collection of object formats, if you like, which we want to maintain in the heap. And the key message is data are allocated in this dynamic area, and on the stack we only maintain references to these beasts. So this is like in Java, so the objects are somewhere in the object store, and on the stack you have references to the objects. It's a bit philosophical, what is the object? Is the object the reference, or is the object the data area for the object? In some sense, yeah, so it's not so clear what one really means by an object. So here, once again, so we have a reference on the stack, and the data areas corresponding to the value in the heap. Data concept in our programming language, we will have corresponding supporting data object there. So the first thing is, now we may go through the list of things which we might want to compute with. The first thing is we have to deal with basic values, and we have to deal with functions. These are the most important things. So a basic value, so everything, every such data object has a tag telling us what kind of object it is, and then, a struct, so several fields, which may take all information, which collect all information necessary for this particular value. So for a basic value, we only have to record the value. So that is easy. So for a function, we have also a tag. This is this f. And we the most important thing, what we will have to maintain in the data object for a function is the code pointer. So this corresponds to the address somewhere in the code section. This is, if you think of C, then everything is just a code pointer, every function, and nothing more. But here now, in functional languages, we need two more things. And I think I briefly mentioned that last time. So one thing is the global pointer. A function may be locally defined, and there it may contain occurrences of variables which are defined outside the function definition. So these must be collected, because you have to, we will kind of, when we discuss functions in detail, we will see examples there. So somehow the values must be frozen and packed into the function, so that when it is called, all information to evaluate the function is at hand. So therefore, we need this global, this pointer, and this points to something which collects the values of all global variables. Now, this is multiple values. It's not just one value. So therefore, we need a data structure which allows us to pack multiple values into one vector. And therefore, this is this next thing here. So therefore, we, as an auxiliary data structure, we need a vector concept. This is this tag V. It has a length, say n, and then not just one field, but n fields. And this, so the next, or you could think of, you have one field which is an array of length n. Yeah. So this is makes up a vector. And later in this lecture, we will see that this vector is a very convenient data structure, which we may also want to make available to the programmer, in tuples. So this is also the way how to one would implement a tuple. Okay, so this was the global pointer. And then we have there one more thing for functions. I think I briefly discussed that. This is this argument pointer. Because a function might take 20 arguments, but these may not be, when it is applied to some arguments, it may be applied to less arguments. So if it is applied to 10 arguments, although it in the end wants to have 20, then only one half of the arguments is available, and so it is still a function. Now a function just taking the remaining arguments, and only when the remaining arguments are also provided, then you can start evaluating. Yeah? So therefore you need the possibility to kind of store all those arguments which have already been provided. And these arguments will be collected in a vector. This is the argument vector, and that is the second argument here. Okay? So this is as a brief explanation of the main three data objects. And typically, if you think of OCaml, this would be sufficient. But if you think of Haskell, then there is one more data object required. This is the concept of a closure. And now here, closure. What is a closure? So a brief explanation of a closure. This is, you have an expression, but you don't know whether its value ever will be needed, will be accessed. And if the value is not accessed, you will not want to evaluate this expression. But since you do not know whether in some future you might want to access the value of this expression, you therefore prepare for the future. That is, you construct a closure. And this closure contains all information which is necessary to evaluate the value of the expression later on. So this is the idea of a closure. So therefore, you have to pack together everything which is required for evaluating the expression. So what is this? So here you see, at least in our implementation, this closure contains two things. The one which is most important, the code, a pointer to the code, which says, please evaluate this code in order to provide the value of the expression. And then the expression may depend on variables, and so you also collect the values of these variables in a concept which we now know about, in a global vector. In a vector containing all the bindings for the variables in the expression. Yeah? And so that's the concept of a closure. Sometimes in the Java context, they also speak of closures when they have just functions of this more or less of that type. Yeah. Okay. Yes, so that is the explanation of the data. Are there questions to these data values? And you see here, there's nothing about structured data, so this functional language only can speak about functions and integers. But later on, we will add more data structures, and I will show you then what you have. And then you will, if you want to have other data, you will have to provide corresponding data objects. Okay. Now, if we have these kind of things in our heap, and then we have to provide the possibility to create these objects. And for that, we kind of, in the style of Java, we provide something like a new construct instruction. Okay, so now the tag here would be, you could think of the tag as a class, then it would, one would use a slightly different syntax. But here, I kind of, instead of having these four classes, I just prefer to have just this instruction new and two arguments. One is the tag, and the other one is the real arguments, which are kind of stored inside. Okay, so this instruction will allocate this the corresponding space, and in the heap will initialize the data fields and return the reference to it. So this is kind of an instruction. I will not provide an implementation for it. This is kind of something which is provided by the abstract data type for our heap. Okay, so now how we will get hold, how we can make use of the heap. Now we have to do to think about code generation. And recall, for C, we already noticed that the same expression could give rise to different forms of code, namely depending on the context. If the expression was on the right-hand side, we were interested in its value, so this was this code R. And if it occurred on the left-hand side of an assignment, we were interested, or in some cases, we were interested in the L value of an expression, and that looked a little bit different. So they were not completely independent, but we could the context could depend. Depending on the context, we might want to generate different kinds of code for the same expression. That was so in imperative languages, and the same thing we will find will also happen in case of functional languages. And in fact, we will distinguish three kinds of code. The most important one is the V code. This corresponds to the code, to the R code, to the code R. So the V code is meant this code generation, this is a function which spills out some instructions. And the sequence of these instructions is meant to evaluate the expression E, to evaluate it to a value, and therefore this V. And now what does it mean that it evaluates the expression E to a value? So clearly it computes what the value is. So if it is 5, now what happens? How is the 5 returned? And the 5 is returned by storing the 5 into the heap and returning a reference to it on the stack. So this is our convention. Yeah? And this is the convention for the code V. Okay, and this also works if it is a function. Then a functional object will be created in the heap containing all information to evaluate the function when it is called. But on the stack, we return a pointer to this F object. Yeah? So this is code V. And then there is another code. This is this code B thing. This is an interesting... one could think of it as an optimization. Because think of this value of an expression which returns an integer value, say 5. So then you want to negate it. Yeah? So this negation operator, we had already this one, this takes a value on top of the stack, but not a reference, but a real value. So if we know that the expression, that the value of the expression will be later on be expected on the stack, namely by this negation operation. Yeah. So once I write it down, so if I have -5, so I could start to generate code for the 5 in isolation. But if I do that, and then the code V would put the 5 in the heap and return the reference on the stack. Now the minus later does not want to have the reference, it wants the 5. So you have to kind of, first you put the 5 into the heap and then you just put it back on the stack. This is kind of inefficient. So it's better if you know already that the value is expected on top of the stack, that you directly write the 5 on top of the stack. So clearly you could view that as an optimization, but it's a very kind of very important optimization, and we provided a special code generation scheme for it. This is this code B. And this is kind of particularly important for basic values, and the goal of it is to evaluate the expression E and return the value of E not in the heap and the reference on the stack, but instead directly on the stack. Okay, so this is the code B. And then that is sufficient for things like OCaml, but it's not sufficient for things like Haskell, because there we have these closure things. So this means it's for certain expressions we want at runtime we do not want to evaluate these, but we want to construct closures. And then these closures will be put into the heap and a reference to the closure returned instead of the reference to the value. Clearly, the closure later on may be evaluated. So inside the closure is somewhere wrapped the code for evaluating the closure. But it is two things. One thing is the code for evaluating the closure, and another thing is the code for constructing the closure. And this code C returns the code for constructing the closure. Okay? So you see here three types of code, but for the same expression, at least in principle, are possible. Yeah? And so clearly this code C thing is perhaps the most contrived in that sense, as we have to always to in our minds keep separate the time point of code generation, the time point, which means the time of executing the code, and in this case constructing the closure, and the time point of later evaluating the closure, which is another time point. So there are 1, 2, 3 time points which we have to keep separate. And for an ordinary like OCaml code, you only have to keep in mind 2 time points, namely the time when you generate the code and the time when you execute the code, and that's it. Yeah. So therefore, this code C is more contrived, and we will have it later. And we concentrate therefore on code V and code B. Okay. And so we have actually, for the moment, we have only I expect you not to have a big picture or the full plan how the code generation will look like or how the code for functions would be. So we start with the simple things. And the idea would be we try to do everything as in the C machine. And this will not work at some point, but we try to do it as much as possible. Yeah. And so there is one main distinction, which I already have said perhaps multiple times. In a functional language, you don't have statements, you only have expressions. So therefore, we only have to look at expressions. So what does C with expressions? And we try to do the same simply. Yeah. So what does... So, and the most closest thing to expression evaluation in C is the code B for an expression. So, for example, code B for a constant. B, so for 5. So what would that be? Very simple. We load the constant on top of the stack. And we already have an instruction for it, and so we use it. So therefore, I use the same one. Yeah? So this is on the easy side. So now what happens with an operator, a unary operator? If you want to have the B code for it, so what do we do? Well, the expression E is meant to provide the argument for the unary operator. And the unary operator takes the argument from the stack. So therefore, for the E, we also use code B. Yeah. So this will evaluate E and return it on the stack. So this is this one. And then we apply the instruction for the unary operator. It's the same like in as we had in C. And the same happens if you have a binary operator. Then we first evaluate the first argument, then we evaluate the second argument, and then we apply the binary operator. Now, yeah, and accordingly, so when I say we first evaluate the first argument and then we evaluate the second argument, then I spoke about runtime, but this means at compile time that we simply concatenate the code snippets. Yeah? Yes, please. Yeah, so this I have smuggled into the slide. We have no idea what it is. It is to make the scheme also work in presence of variables. SD is the abbreviation for stack distance, and it is a provision, and it is a consequence of this an amazing fact which we will. I will kind of tell it you this secret right away, although it is very secret, so that we do the addressing of variables in functional languages like this, like OCaml or Haskell, is not relative to the frame pointer, as one might have expected, but relative to the stack pointer. And that is a bit weird, because the variables are at fixed places in the stack, but the stack pointer is moving. So that means if we want to access the same X, then and the stack pointer moves away, so we cannot use it use always the same address, but we have to use a different address, relative address, depending on where the stack pointer is. And therefore, we keep track of the stack distance. This will allow us to fix the same spot in the stack, also the stack pointer is moving up and down. By the way, the same thing is also possible in principle for C, and some modern C compilers also do not address relative to the frame pointer, but simply to the relative to the stack pointer. And this moving around, up and down of the stack pointer is not so in imperative languages, it's not so big a problem, because typically there the stack pointer moves up and down only when expressions are evaluated, and in real architectures, expressions are evaluated in registers. So therefore, the stack pointer does not change at all during a function call. And then you can use it as it's a pointer, so you can address relative to it, and so they do it. Yeah. There are only very few rare situations where you cannot use the stack pointer. Yes?
What could be an advantage to use this kind of referencing in an imperative language like C?
To use the stack pointer instead?
Yes, exactly. I saw it that GCC compiles code which does actually the same thing, but it made, personally, it made my life much worse.
In some sense, the frame pointer is, so if you save one pointer, that's a kind of extra advantage. So, yeah. Okay. So now I revealed the mystery behind the stack pointer. Also, how this stack distance. So we will always keep track of it in all our things. Ah, yeah, and that I should already mention here. We do not yet fully understand, I did not provide enough details that you have any chance to fully understand how we use the stack distance for access to the variables. I only indicated that this is the reason why we maintain it. And you see here that SD is the stack distance before executing the code for B. Yeah? So this means when we have generated the code for that, then one more stack pointer is on top of the stack. Therefore, the stack distance for the second expression has increased by 1. So therefore, this plus 1. So this we understand. Okay? And you see here that this little calculation, so we have not seen the other ones, but we will see that the stack distance is exactly, for every program point, you can exactly determine the stack distance. So it's kind of a static property of the code. Okay, so now here comes the if-then-else, and this is kind of a functional if-then-else. So this means that if E1, if this E0 evaluates to 0, then we will return the value of E2. Otherwise, we will return the value of E1. So this is that is the meaning here. And for the code B thing, so here everything is for code B, what would we do? So the first thing is the E0 should be evaluated, and then the argument, the result is used by the jump at zero instruction. The jump at zero instruction expects its value on top of the stack. So therefore, for E0, we also need the code B. Yeah? Therefore, we have code B here, also for the E0. And the stack distance before executing the code for E0 is SD. Okay. Then, after having executed that, the stack has increased by 1, but the jump at 0 will kind of reduce it again. So that means afterwards, the stack distance is before. So therefore, here we have the same stack distance, and here also. Yeah. And since overall, from the if-then-else, we expect a value on top of the stack and not a reference, so therefore, we can also use code B for the E1 and for the E2. And otherwise, the control flow here is the same as we have seen it already several times, multiple times, in, for example, for C. Yeah. So here, if the condition is not satisfied, then we jump to the else part. And if it is satisfied, the condition is true, meaning the value is different from 0, then we simply continue and go to the evaluation of E1. And afterwards, we have an unconditional jump behind the code for the else part. Okay? So in that sense, this is no surprise, and it is meant, and it is the goal of this slide is to convince you that we can reuse some ideas which we had already foreseen. Okay. So then here is some of the explanation which I already gave you for the scheme when explaining the schema. One thing which I did not explain, but you might have guessed, is that there is again such a row around, which is the current address environment. And we will discuss what kind of data we maintain in the address environment later. For the moment, we assume that there is something like that, and we will code generation for expressions will depend on it, because the expression might contain variables. I have not yet shown you anything about variables, but it could be, and therefore we have to take precautions for it. Then the stack difference we also have already. I have told you about it. So for that is incremented whenever something is put on the stack and decremented when something is popped from the stack. And, okay. Then this op1 and op2, they correspond to this operator. So I did not have mal or div or things sub. As for the C machine, this we would also use here. So I was too lazy to repeat these things. So that was for the code B for expressions. Now there are many expressions, or there could be several expressions which do not look like these ones, these forms which I have shown you. And for these, we make a kind of, this is if you like a catch-all, which is responsible for all other expressions for whose value should end up on top of the stack. So for that, we could also use the more general code generation. We could kind of generate code by means of this code V scheme. This would kind of provide us code which returns the value of E on somewhere in the heap and only returns a reference to it on top of the stack. And then we just apply one new fancy operation, which is this get basic, which is kind of dereferencing operator. It dereferences the reference on top of the stack, hoping that the reference points to a basic value, and then just takes this value and puts it on top of the stack. So it's just that. It's kind of the star operator, if you like. And we could make it type safe in this sense, that it checks whether the value is really a basic value. And if it is not a basic value, then the evaluation breaks. Otherwise, the value is returned. So there's one more little thing to say about. So if functional languages take some care in providing type systems, and these type systems have the big advantage that if the compiler thinks something is a basic value, then it is really a basic value. And it may not happen that you have a function there. This would be a type error. This would be excluded by the type system. So if we have such a brilliant type system, then we could kind of remove this kind of testing, because the type system ensures that this never can happen. So if you are a compiler writer and you are designing this machine and writing everything from scratch, I would suggest to have two modes. One mode where this test is done, check is done, and one mode where you can turn it off. So as long as you develop the compiler, you turn it on, and then you will find at least several of your compiler bugs. And afterwards you switch it off if you are sure that your type system really is working and your code generation is perfect. So this was this get basic thing. Now let us see, this was code B. Now what is with code B? Is it more complicated? Is it very difficult? Now it turns out that it's not so difficult. So let us see what code B would do to a basic value B. So this is 5. Yeah. So clearly we know how we can load this value 5 on top of the stack by loading the constant. This is our old instruction from the C machine. Now, but this is not the place where code V is meant to return its result. So we have to put it now from the stack somewhere into the heap and return a reference. So we have no way to do this so far. So therefore, we just on the spot invent a new instruction, which is this make basic instruction. here is the make basic thing. So it takes the value on top of the stack and puts it into the heap and returns it instead the reference. So this is kind of wrapping, like if you use a constructor integer for the value 17 in Java. Yes, wrapping and unwrapping somehow. Okay, so now we got, so this was not so difficult. Now what happens, this is now interesting. If we want to have code V for this application of a unary operator to an expression E. Because the result is expected in the heap, but the result of E is best delivered on top of the stack. So therefore we first, and that is, we first generate code B for E, and then we apply the operator, and then we put it in the heap. Yeah? So by this, in some sense, if you like, the context changes. For the overall expression, we expect it in the heap, but for the sub-expression, we expect the result on the stack. And the same applies also for this binary application of a binary operator. There, the two arguments, the results for the two arguments are expected on top of the stack. Then we apply the operator, and then we put the result into the heap. And also now, for the, what do we do for a conditional expression? The E0, we definitely need the result on top of the stack, therefore the code B. Then we do the control flow as before, but the two argument, the values of the E1 and E2 are expected in the heap, because overall we want to have code V. Yeah? So therefore we have here code V and code V. Okay? So this was also not too difficult, and we feel a little bit more, again, a little bit more confident that here we have a, yeah, that we can meet the challenges here. Now the most interesting thing clearly, and this I'll have deliberately left out so far, are the variables. How do we access variables? And that's that is now the very important point. And now for accessing variables, we first have to analyze what kind of variables there are around and whether we have to deal with them, how we deal with them. So the first thing is, as before, we distinguish here also between local and global variables. So consider, for example, this function definition f here. Here is a function definition f. And we just, if you look at this, so this is defines this name f. So I perhaps this name f by means of this function, functional expression. And this functional expression, if you see there, there is this parameter. The parameter, I would say, is a local variable. It introduces a local variable of the function because the scope of it is restricted to the body of the function. And afterwards, outside, it's not visible. So this is this A. But there is something, and then there is this B. So this B is a local variable inside the function. And then there is this C. Now this C is not, is kind of imported, if you like, from outside. So therefore, the C inside the function f, inside the function f, the C is global. Yeah, while the A and the B are local. And there's one more thing. Now, if one thinks about global variables, there is the question, if you later, the function f may be passed around and evaluated at some point. Okay, here it is not passed around, but just immediately called. But the question is, when you have a function, when you evaluate a function, and you access the global variables, which kind of values for these global variables would you obtain when you look up the variable. And in modern languages, you typically use something which is static scoping instead of or static binding. So static scopes and static binding. That means that the value of a global variable is determined at construction time of the function and not at evaluation time of the function. So that is one of the, at least a story which I was told, and I retell it always because I find it a nice, find it nice. Whether it's true or not is not so important, but the story is still nice. That when the people constructed the programming language Lisp, then they had in mind to implement the lambda calculus. So that was their idea. Who has ever heard of the lambda calculus before? Ah, so there are even people knowing about lambda calculus. And lambda calculus has static scoping and static binding, and there's no dynamic binding. But they didn't know how to implement that, and therefore, when there were global the old Lisp semantics was, when you have a variable, you try it and you find, then you dynamically start scanning the stack for the last binding of that variable which you find on the stack. The dynamically last binding. And that is kind of something else but the static binding. And therefore, so at some point, people, now you may wonder whether this is kind of a bug or a feature. So clearly, since it's part of the programming language, it's a feature. Yeah? But on the other hand, if you compare it with the requirements which they wanted to, or the goals which they wanted to reach, namely to implement the lambda calculus, it was a bug, definitely. On the other hand, it was a very influential bug, because the dynamic binding of Lisp allowed to implement something like this, the kind of binding which you have in object-oriented languages. Because by that you can, methods, if you like, they are determined, the method which is called at a particular place is determined with respect to the runtime value of the object arriving there. So it's kind of dynamic binding. So and that kind of originates in some sense from the dynamic binding of Lisp, which was in essence design a bug. So that's kind of an interesting thing. So that sometimes bugs are not only harmful but sometimes even productive and lead to unexpected consequences. Okay. So but that means that if we kind of, and we know if we will want to construct that, we have already, when I have shown you 20 minutes ago, the kind of objects which we provide for that, there was, we said we have to kind of wrap together, when you construct the functional object, we have to wrap into this object the values of the global variables. So it means at that point we find C has value 5. So therefore we have to provide this value 5 in the global vector which we supply together with the function. Yeah, and then when we will access the global variables, we will do it through this global vector. That is the idea. While the local variables is like we did with local variables so far, we put them onto the stack. Okay, so that is here again this idea. The global variables are collected and put into a vector, and this is the global vector, and that is maintained on the heap. And we only have access it through a pointer or reference. And so the variables in the global vector, so if you put there x0, x2, x2, then we will the relative addresses there will start will be relative to the start point of the global vector. So we start with address 0, then 1, then 2, and so on. Yeah. So they are therefore consecutively addressed, the global variables starting from 0 according to some numbering of the global variables. So, and here, one more thing. So, when we constructed address environments for C, we always had to worry about the sizes of types. So, here, everything is reference. So, therefore, the size of every data thing is counted for one. So, every variable is only counted one because it is the value of it will be a reference to some other object. So, therefore, it's easy. Okay. Yeah. Now that is we have I have already told you that these global vectors in which we collect the values for global for global variables are that these global vectors will be supplied with the F object or the C object, but now at some point we will have to access the global variables, and then we kind of have to keep. Then we have to kind of maintain somewhere the current global vector, the current global vector, and that how can we do it in the easiest way? So well, our design choice is to just provide a new register. This is this what register GP or global pointer, which holds a reference to the current global vector. Yeah, and then if you want to access this global variable 2, then we will take global this global pointer plus 2, and that's it. Yeah. Okay. So now that means since local variables are maintained on the stack, so locals and globals are treated completely differently. And therefore, we have to record the information, whether something is global or local, explicitly. And that is, therefore, this row contains this information, local or global, and a relative address. Okay? Now for the local variables. So that's now the second part. We already, where do we maintain the local variables? So if you have a function call, then we will have a stack frame. And now inside the stack frame, there will be the locus and the parameters, the actual parameters. So now let us look here kind of one such function application. So function application, there's this E prime, which is an expression. It need not be a function name. It could be also, Well, what is a function name? Also, a function name is a variable. So, and the variable must be evaluated, so you must look up the value of the variable. Yeah? And then you have this E0 to EM-1, which are sum of the actual parameters or required by the expression. And one important thing is that the arities of this function E prime is not need not be in any relation to the M. So it could be that in this function application there are less arguments provided as E prime requires, or that there are more arguments provided as the E prime requires. How can it be that that we supply more arguments than the E prime requires? How is this possible? Now, the E prime itself might be an expression which does a lot of computation and in the end returns a function. So you can also return a function as a result. Then this function which the E prime returns then could consume the remaining arguments. Yeah? So therefore, since E prime might return a function, this M could in all this E0 to EM minus 1, some extra arguments could be provided, which are only consumed then by the returned function. Yeah? So therefore, and that is also makes things a little bit more difficult or kind of subtle for implementing functional languages, that you have to deal with undersupply and with oversupply of arguments. Okay? And now, so if you have this expression, this function application, E0, E prime applied to all the other things, you could do it in, there are multiple ways how to arrange, or there are at least two ways how to arrange the arguments. So you could kind of start with the innermost argument, E0, evaluate that, then E1, and so on, and by that arrange them in this way on the stack, and then in the end evaluate the E prime. So this one could do. This would allow, if the frame pointer is the last, points to the last cell below the parameters, then we could use the frame pointer for addressing the arguments. But the local variables inside E prime could not be addressed relative to the frame pointer. Why? Because E prime, the function E prime, does not know how many parameters have been supplied. There could be contexts where nothing is supplied, and other contexts where 100 variables are supplied. And so this means that the frame pointer is either 0 memory cells away or 100 memory cells away. So that means the frame pointer is not very reliable for addressing the local variables in E prime. So that is the disadvantage. And there's another disadvantage. If E prime, it could happen that this E prime is a function or will evaluate to a function which is applied to three more arguments. Then where in the... So if E prime, let me write that, E prime evaluates to F applied A0, A1, A2. Now, where in the ordering of parameters this E0 to A0 to A2 should be, where should they go? Well, these should go below, because they are closer to the F. The F must be applied to A0, A1, A2, and then E0, E1, and so on. Yeah? Or if some of these things have been consumed, say, if these things have been consumed by the application of E prime, and then only the EM minus 1 remains, but if then the partial application and the application of E prime to the first M minus 1 parameters returns this partial application, then this A0, A1, A2 must be placed here after having eaten up some of the arguments. So somehow it's difficult to do this kind of, it's unnatural to do this kind of manipulation of the stack. So it's much more clever, therefore, if we do the ordering in the it's much more clever if we arrange the ordering in the opposite way. That is, we proceed by evaluating the arguments from the outside to the inside. So we first we evaluate them from right to left. So first we evaluate the EM minus 1, putting it most downward into the stack, because it is the last one to be consumed, and putting the E0 on top, because it's the first argument to be consumed. And now if this E prime, for example, turns out to be a partial application, then it will, and some more arguments are already supplied, then they will kind of be put also on top of the stack and add further parameters there. So in some sense, it isn't in the way how we presented the function application in C, it is not so big a surprise, because so there also we decided to evaluate the arguments from right to left. This was there due to this ... functions, which is also where you have also variable lists of actual parameters. Yes. Yes, that you—that's true. You could also do it like that's an interesting possibility. So if you take the all the actual parameters, put them into a vector. Yeah, you can do that. But the problem is, if then in this case here, where you add further, you would kind of have to prolong the vector. But that's okay, that one could do. I think there are some people who do it like that. So there's no nothing against that. This would make make accessing parameters different from accessing real local variables. And now here we treat local variables and parameters identical for the accessing. But you could do that. But also there, you would kind of, would one do it? One would kind of do it so that the vector, if you want to make it a vector, you would put the A1 on A1 here and this EM minus 1 to the end. This is important because you consume here and you have then fixed relative addresses to the start point of the argument vector. And then when you have consumed them, you would kind of eat them up and then have the rest. Yeah, so one could do things like that. Okay, so more questions. Now if we... still, if we have this arrangement, then the frame pointer is no longer very good for addressing, is also not very good for addressing parameters, because this position might be arbitrarily far away from the frame pointer. So that, for that reason, the frame pointer is... And inside the function f, I don't know where the frame pointer is, because inside the function, the body of the function, of a function, I do not know to how many arguments this function is applied. So therefore, I cannot use the frame pointer inside the function f for code generation. So the E prime is evaluated first. Assume that the arguments here are all already evaluated. So here you have values. And now you start evaluating the function. This is this E prime. Just the function. No argument has yet been consumed. It's just an expression which returns a function. Now this could be something like a G. And now the value of G, there was for in somewhere in the code, there was something like let G f of A0, A1, A2. Now the real function so is f, and f applied to arguments A0, A1, A2. Now where do you put this A0, A1, A2? And you have to put these arguments before the E0, because it's more to the left. And that would be this situation. Yeah. Any more questions? Okay. So this. So therefore, since the frame pointer once again is set when for a function call, in order to kind of limit, give a lower limit to the actual parameters which are supplied to the function. Somehow you need to know how many there are. Therefore, we need the frame pointer. Yes, but it is not very useful for accessing the parameters from inside the function, because there, for accessing, you would perhaps start from here. Yeah, so A0 is the innermost argument, so this is the leftmost argument. A1 is the next one, so you would like to address relative to this position. Now, this position is not given by the frame pointer, but this position is given, or this position here is given by the stack pointer at when entering a function. And now, the only thing is that the stack pointer may change over time, but it changes by means of the stack distance. So at that point, stack distance is 0, and if you work through your function, the stack distance might increase. But still, since it's at every program point in the code, you know how much the stack distance is. If it is 5, you subtract the 5 and get the parameter. Okay, so this is the stack distance. So the we address relative, you might think of it as we kind of freeze the value of the stack pointer when entering the procedure, the function. Yeah, this is this SP0. And then the stack distance counts how much the real stack pointer deviates from the this frozen stack pointer. And then we kind of subtract it from the stack from the current stack pointer to get this SP0, and then the relative addresses of the locals and the formals give us the access to the parameters and the locals. And the relative stack distance is the relative distance to this SP0. Okay? That is the message. The difference between the current value of SP and SP0 is the stack distance. And once again, this SP0... This is the value of the stack pointer when a function body is entered. Okay. And then, now thinking of that, looking at this picture again, so then you see that the formal parameters get relative addresses 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so on. In some sense, this is quite similar to C, only there we had the organizational cells also so the formal parameters were below the organizational cells. So therefore, it did not start with 0, but with minus 3. But otherwise, it was the same. And the locals, then the locals would be here, and so they get relative addresses 1, 2, 3, and so on. Yeah. Okay. And now the absolute address of the ith formal parameter, therefore, is SP0. The relative address of the ith formal is minus I. So you have to add SP0 and the relative address. So giving that you get relative to the current stack pointer, you kind of have stack pointer minus stack distance gives you the SP0, and then you subtract I. Then you get the ith parameter. Now for the locals, I said I will use the generic names y1, y2, y3, and then the relative addresses will be 1, 2, 3, and then they get, for those, these are positive addresses, so the ith local would then be this one. Yeah, so then you add the I. Like this. Okay? So this is the simple organization of the stack frame. Okay, and now, so if we want to get the access, get hold of a variable x, that is now the important thing. Now we want to have the value of the expression x with an address environment row and stack distance SD. And then, so there are two different things. It depends on whether it is a local or a global. I use a macro here, which this is this macro getvar, which produces the real instruction. So this I will show you. This macro is defined here. But then I will want to point you at one more thing. If you have a Haskell type of language and you want to have the value of a variable, it does not suffice to push the corresponding reference on top of the stack because the reference might point to a closure. The value might not have yet been produced. So therefore, you push the reference on top of the stack, and then you need another instruction which checks whether it is a closure or not, and if it is a closure, evaluates the closure and replaces it by the expression, by the value. So therefore this eval. So if you have OCaml or SML, such a call by value language, then you kind of do not need this eval thing. Then you just push the reference to the variable on top of the stack. Yeah? Now let us see what kind of instruction it is to get the reference to the value of x. Let us assume that the relative address is I. And now if we have a local variable, then we kind of, if we have a local variable, then the idea is to take the difference, compute the difference of stack distance and I, so subtract I from the stack distance, and then use this push log instruction. Push log, we don't know what it is. I show you it here. This is push log. So if you take an n, if the push log n gives you, take the stack pointer, the current stack pointer, subtract n, and the value of that, which is stored there, you push on top of the stack. Yeah? So that is kind of the idea. You subtract this argument here from the current stack pointer. So if you subtract SD minus I from the stack pointer, then this means you compute SP minus SD minus I, and that is SP minus stack distance plus I. And this SP minus stack distance is exactly this SP0, our reference address, which means reference address plus I. Yeah. So therefore, we must make a minus here because we must have a minus here, because the value which is computed here is subtracted from the stack pointer. Okay? This is the most complicated thing of all the translation of functional languages, to have this kind of address calculation, which we require due to this addressing relative to the stack pointer. Okay, and then for globals, it's much simpler. There we only have this, we take the relative address and pass it to this, to a new instruction, push glob, because it is another one. Well, how will that work? Push glob, globals, we said, are in the global vector. The GP points to the current global vector, and we index the ith element. So, here is the push glob. We have a global vector. We have this relative address I inside this vector, and we use this I to index this vector and push the corresponding value on top of the stack. Okay, here is this argument which I scribbled onto the slide to show that this, for the locals, the calculation here is the right one. Okay, so these were push log and push glob. Once again, I show you this, the code generation. So that is what you do with when you use this instruction, either this push log or this push glob, to put a reference to the value of x on top of the stack, and then you do the eval to check whether it is a closure. If it is a closure, it is evaluated. If it is not a closure, you are done. And how this eval is implemented, we will see later. So currently, it's just for us a black box. For code generation, no problem. It's a placeholder for a functionality which we provide later. Okay. So now we are ready to make a little experiment in code generation. We take B plus C, so that we should be able to generate code for. And we assume that B is a local with relative address 1, and G is a global with relative address 0, and the stack distance is 1. So then we should be able to generate code for it. So, and you see here that the first thing is we have to do the evaluate the B, and since this is and get the value, the basic value of it, because we have to supply it to the operator plus, and then we have to do the same for the C, then we have to do the add, and then we have to make a basic value. So that is the left thing. Somehow is the straightforward concatenation and recollection of this, of how to deal with arithmetic expressions. So that is easy, but the interesting thing clearly is, what do we have to do here and there? And now, in order to, therefore, for that, we do have to keep track of the stack distances before evaluating a particular instruction. And otherwise, we cannot know what kind of what you have to do there. So therefore, I propose, when you write little examples, that you always write it in this way, and I will do it in all other examples also, that for every code line which I generate in the examples, I write the stack distance before. So then, knowing that gives us the required information. So here is the sequence of stack distances. So we start with stack distance 1, then something is pushed on top of the stack, so this increases to 2, then comes the eval, which does not change this 2, then applying the get basic will also not increase the 2, so therefore here is still 2. Therefore here is still 2, because get basic replaces the reference by a value. So stack distance stays the same. Then this push glob will increase the value, then the eval will not change, the get basic will not change, the add, so then adding will decrease. And then making basic, the value basic will not change. So that ultimately the code, executing the code of this expression E, will increase the stack distance by 1. Before it was 1, afterwards it is 2. And that's okay. Yeah? So now let us see that that was for the, by that I hope to have convinced you that my calculation of the stack distance is the right one. Now let us see here. So here now we have to do, must be very certain of what we are doing, because these address off by one errors kind of kill us. So then everything would be wrong. So here the stack distance is 1 and the relative address of B is also 1. Therefore we have to compute 1 minus 1 and that is 0. Therefore push log 0. Okay, so that was already all. We only have to be careful for that, but also it was not so difficult. Now here in this place, for the C, it is more easier. It is easier because C is a global variable, and so it has the relative address is 0. So that is kind of goes into this push glob instruction, as is. Yeah. So in this sense, it was easy. And now if you see, if it is not called by need but called by value environment, we do not have to generate this eval instructions, then the code would be simpler in this way. Okay, is there a question? So that was now let us relax a bit and see what we can do with if further local variables are introduced. And these local variables are introduced by means of let expressions. So here I have kind of a multiple let. One could do it also one by one, but we could also do it just in a go, a kind of large amount of let expressions. How do we deal with it? Now the idea is that a let, here the first let, introduces the local variable y1, which then may be used in the next expression, e2 and e3 and so on until e0. So y1 comes into being, so to speak, after this in. And then you can use it. And so if we want to generate code for it, what will we have to do? So we expect the program, when it is executed, to do two different things depending on whether we are in the call by value or in a call by need environment. If we are in a call by value environment, we would evaluate the E1 to a value and then bind, introduce this variable Y1, and this Y1 should receive the value of E1. And so on for all the other variables, write what? Here should be yn equals. Amazing. This slipped away. Okay. Write until yn, and then after yn, all the local variables are in place, and then you can use all of them in this e0. Yeah? And after this evaluating the e0, all the y1 to yn stop to exist, so they have to be removed again. Yeah? So now what happens if we have a call by, if we are in a call by need environment? In a call by need, it's the same, only with one little exception, that instead of evaluating the e1 to en, we would construct closures for later evaluating the expressions E1 to EN. So we would only create closures, and then we could use the this E in E0, we could use the Y1s and Y2s and so on, but and would evaluate them only when the values are really required. So that means the code generation is like that. We kind of the code for E looks as follows. We first evaluate the generate code for evaluating E1. What is the result of it? The result of it is that the stack increases, and on top of the stack now is a reference to the value of E1 or to a closure for the E1. But the stack distance has increased. Now this means we have added a new local variable. We simply have now to record that this Y1 is located at this particular stack distance. Yeah? So that the Y1 is located, the stack distance has the offset has increased by 1, so therefore the Y1 is mapped to the relative address local, so it is a local, and it is recorded as stack distance plus 1 for the first Y. And we simply, so just evaluating the Y1 and leave the reference on top of the stack, implements the first let. Now comes the next let, which means we now have to evaluate the next expression. Now with two modifications. The first modification is that the stack distance has increased because there's one more reference on top of the stack. And also the address environment has increased because now the address environment, this row 1, is obtained from row by adding the binding for the Y1 and so on. So by that we successively end up with more and more and more references on top of the stack until we are here. Yeah? Then the stack distance, so when we are done with that, now n references are on top of the stack. So here's the first one, and so n reference. So the stack distance over, now remove all this weird stuff. Overall, for the E0, n references have been added onto the stack, corresponding to the n local variables which have been added. So the stack distance now has increased by n. And then we evaluate the E0, and from the overall expression we want to have a value. So therefore we also make the code V sequence for the E0. So that's it. And the address environment, now this row N, is the original row extended with the bindings with the addresses, the relative addresses for the local variables Y1 to Yn. Where Y, once again, Y1 gets stack distance plus 1, Y2 gets stack distance plus 2, and so on. Well, this is always the old stack distance. Okay? And, so here now you might be a little bit, perhaps, well, you read the slide, so you see, but I wrote here this code C thing, just in preparation of when we go for the call by need code generation, and in case for the call by value, we will not create any closures here, but evaluate the expressions E1 to EN right away, which means we generate code for evaluating these expressions right away. That is, we just change the code generation scheme there from C to V. So that is perhaps the most natural way how you may think of it, and think of this modification with C only for the case when we try to delay evaluation of expressions as much as possible. Okay. Is there some question? Now, we must make an example immediately. So here is let A equals 19 in let B equals A times A in A plus B. Yeah? How would we do that? So now we assume, let us assume that we are in a call by value environment, that the original stack distance is zero, because this is a kind of a full program, if you like, which we can evaluate right away. And so we are in a call by value function language, so that we don't need these eval things. So that this makes the code shorter and easier to understand. So, okay, so how would we proceed? So the first thing is, let A equals 19. This is the first thing which we must translate. Now 19 is translated into that, and that's it already. Yeah. So this kind of creates the value of 19 on top of the stack, and this is the binding of A. So we only have to record that A has the relative address 1. Yeah? Okay, so then now we have to evaluate A times A. And what is the stack distance? The stack distance is 1. So we therefore, we have to access the first A is push log 1 minus 1, which is 0. And then we get the value of it by doing this get basic thing. So this is these two instructions. And now we have to get the second instance of A. Now we have to look here, what is our current stack distance? So this is 2. But the relative address of A is 1. So in order to get the second A, we have to do push log 2 minus 1, which is 1. So therefore you see here, these two things are distinct. Yeah. So the same variable is accessed by two different instructions. But that is kind of so this is kind of to be expected if we address relative to the stack pointer and the stack pointer changes. But this also makes clear that you cannot understand this code as easily as we understood C machine code. You can only understand this code if you keep track of the stack distances. Otherwise, you are lost. And this therefore, this, yeah. Okay, so now we have pushed the second copy of A on top of the stack. We do this, we get the value of it by making this get basic. And now we can do the multiplication. And then we can make a basic the value of it. And that is now the value of B, which is on top of the stack. And then we can proceed to evaluate A plus B. So now we have to, once again, we have to get the value of A. The current stack pointer is, the current stack distance is 2. 2 minus 1 is 1. Therefore, push log 1 will push the A. Now the B was in relative address L2. So now, yeah, we push log 1 and then doing this get basic thing gets the value of A. Now we have to do the value of B. This the stack distance now is 3. 3 minus 2 is 1. So doing now, so this is an interesting phenomenon. We do again a push log 1, but this does not push the A, but now pushes the B, because the stack distance has changed. Yeah? So the same instruction could also refer to different variables, depending on the stack distance. And then we get the basic value of that B. Then we can do the add and make the basic thing. And then we now have evaluated the E0. But now we have to squeeze out the locals remove them. And this is this slide 2. This is also was here. I have not explained that. So in the end, we have to move down the value of E0 and memory cells downward into the stack to squeeze out the locals which have gone out of scope. Time is over. Thank you for your attention. We continue tomorrow.